Hello, I'm Liz Bobo. Welcome to Reflections on Life, the monthly podcast that I do with the Howard Community College digital radio program. Today, I'm very pleased to have with me a neighbor. I did not know he was a neighbor until recently, or I knew he was a neighbor, but I didn't know what his life's work had been. And Steve Stewart, who lives in Harper's Choice here in Columbia, has played a very major role. Dr. Stewart has played a very major role in the criminal justice system here in the state of Maryland. He is published on the subject and deeply knowledgeable, not only from the perspective of how to run prisons, but also from the perspective of justice and human dignity. So I'm very much looking forward to this interview with you, Steve. And so would you tell us what it was that attracted you to get into this for your life's work?
Well, thank you, Liz. And I want to thank you for your previous work, because you and I started talking to each other in Annapolis during some of the sessions, and you were very, very positive about prison reform and education reform. So I really thank you for all that, and good to know we're neighbors. So I had no idea I'd ever be, you know, people don't grow up thinking they're going to be a correctional teacher or a correctional officer. I mean, some people might, but I did. And I was very much, I wanted to be a teacher, and I did become a teacher, a public school teacher in Chicago and in Washington, D.C. And I taught reading, Italian, English, history, a whole bunch of stuff while I was doing that. When I perceived all the reading problems I had with my kids in Washington, D.C. and in Chicago, too, I went back to the University of Maryland to do a Ph.D. in reading disabilities so I could learn how to take care of this in a classroom, and with the idea of coming back to the public schools as a reading teacher or reading, training people to be reading teachers. And I had a project that was, I was asked to do a project in the state prisons, but, you know, just, and as a grad student, you don't have any money. So I said, okay. And I went out there with some trepidation, and I loved it. And so I worked a day or two a week, and I asked them at some point when I was finished my doctorate, could I get a job? And they hired me. So it was just that simple. So I went to prison right after I finished my PhD. So, and then the rest was just, you know, history sort of, you know.
Good. Well, it was a very good match, I think, for you and the career you chose. It's more than a career to you, though. I think it strikes me to be your life mission in addition to your career, mm-hmm. and one that is very much in need of people who have a broad perspective. You wrote in one of the papers you sent me, I asked you if you would send me some of your publications that I could read up on to get a better background on you and your work. And I quote from one of them, "There were 875,000 adults paroled from prison and state institutions at the end of 2016, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics. In addition, several million more individuals are released from local jails each year. Now, how many of these released prisoners go on to learn a trade or a profession or have a job? And how many of them end up being imprisoned again?
Well, statistics show that after 3 years, most people come back in one way or another. Now, they can be, some of the statistics say rearrested, but they don't go back. Some say recommitted. So there's various statistics on that. But unfortunately, many of the people, if not most of them, come back. We don't know, unfortunately, we don't have a good collection system about what kind of jobs they get or how many get jobs. I'll give you a good example of the education statistics we don't have. I got a little project going right now, trying to persuade the three high school equivalency companies, the GED and the TASC and HISET. Those are the three equivalency tests given around the country. Maryland uses GED. We don't know. We don't have a total how many GEDs are given in prison each year. That just isn't published, because if you ask Maryland, they'll tell you. If you ask Virginia, they'll probably tell you. But you have to go around and collect the data from 50 states. Nobody does that. So we're trying to get, I'm working with a senator and a congressman in D.C., asking these companies to ask the states to release it. The state controls the data. So we're gonna try to get the states to voluntarily give us annual report. And we're asking them to go back 20 years for the GED and 6 or 7 for the newer tests to see how many people we have. We don't know. We did know until the GED, that was the only one of the equivalency tests, but then there became 3 in 2014. So they stopped doing it. The states took over control. But before that, we didn't know. And the same thing's true of professions. Professions don't tell you how many people became automotive technical specialists or how many people got their HVAC certifications or what have you, unless you go to the state and ask and if they can identify that. So every time the only way we can find this out is to ask each state if they're keeping track of what they are, but nobody has a repository. So it's very hard to do research. RAND Corporation has pointed this out, that we don't have basic data on the results of our programs, particularly education, in this, because that's what they were studying.
Okay, quite a lot of unraveling needs to be done, it sounds like. How many of those released from prison go on to learn a trade or a profession? And the other side of the question, how many end up being imprisoned again?
Well, we just don't know. I mean, I know individuals through my work in Maryland, but some people I've met nationally who are ex-offenders. We just don't know. A lot of people who get out of jail and prison, they're not going to tell you anyway. They're ashamed and they don't want to report. And very frequently, people will get certification while they're in prison, like automotive technology, construction trades. We do a lot of that in many states. We just don't know who's going and using that certification. So it's very difficult, you know, but we do know who comes back because they keep track of that, you know, rearrest, reconviction. And again, after 3 years, most people have come back to prison for one reason or another. It could be just a violation of parole or it could be a whole new crime, but most people come back after 3 years, statistically, okay. Some states higher than others.
Okay. What would you say are the major barriers to prisoners reentering society successfully?
Well, let me give you some things. See, that's not an area I spend a lot of time being very specific with, but the Pew Foundation, I pull up an article, just, you know, I could give you some general stuff, but let me give you some of the stuff they do. In work and housing, people who are coming out of prison are often limited in what jobs they can get. Housing, they might be ineligible for housing subsidies, and every state's different. People come out often with court debts, and they have to pay them, and if they don't pay them, they can go back. Professions often ban people. For years in Maryland, we had a barbering program and we had a cosmetology program at the women's, barbering for the men's. They could complete those programs and pass the exams behind bars, and they weren't allowed to get their state board refused to give them a license. So what were they doing that for?
How long ago was that, Steve?
You know, I don't know when it ended, but when I left the state service 10 or 15 years ago after, you know, I retired and went on to do some other stuff, it was still in place. But now I understand that that's changed, thankfully. Mm-hmm. But there's other trades that do that too. You can't get people licensed in heating and air conditioning because the industry does not want to send those people into people's homes, regardless mm-hmm. of the crime. So there's a whole example right there. Trades that have been much better, automotive and construction trades have been much better at hiring people.
And are they continuing to increase in their hiring or?
Yes and no. I mean, construction trades generally are pretty good at that. I had personal experience. I won't mention the name of the company that we buy or lease our cars from, but we have Vehicles for Change is a program in Maryland where ex-offenders get totally licensed. They get their certificates, ASC certificate. It's a national certificate. So, and I said to our dealer one day, I said, I hope you're hiring ex-offenders. I understand that your company is signed on to this. And I was told privately, they don't do that. They signed on, but they're not going to do that. And so, you know, companies can sign on and they can, oh yeah, we're all doing this. But then when it comes down to the practice, they don't, or they're doing it in a very limited way. So Johns Hopkins University Hospital is a good example of somebody who employs ex-offenders. They hire them for jobs. If they had drug offense, they're not going to work in a pharmacy, but they could work maintenance. They could do other jobs. They could work in computer stuff, you know. They're very good at that.
I did not know that. And I'm surprised I didn't. Having been born and grown up in Baltimore, as was my mom, who just dearly, dearly loved the city, I did not know that. That's a very good thing about all the other good things that Hopkins does, right?
Yeah, I'm happy because my wife and I certainly spent a lot of our insurance money in her system. So I appreciate that. But here's another thing. Ban the box laws. That's a big thing right now currently. You go for hire for a job and there's a box that says you have a previous offense, whether it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And you're not allowed, and 28 states have banned that for state jobs, but they don't usually ban it for private companies. And universities, the whole thing about applying for college is the same thing, ban the box. What they're trying to do is that you can't ask that question as part of a qualification. What you can do later is ask that question, you know, once they've qualified. And then the person can give their explanation and all that. But Vanda Box is a big deal because once you get all this training or you apply and then you can't get a job. So in many states, the private industry, private companies are exempted from that. So as soon as they find out somebody has an offense, they're not even going to interview them. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on. We're a very punitive country. Europe is much different in this regard. Even countries like China and, you know, that we consider kind of, you know, I spent a little time in China and Japan, you know, going to some meetings and working with people there. And they have a whole different attitude. We have a very conservative attitude in this country, a very punitive attitude.
It's interesting, though, from my perspective, and I'm not proud of how small my knowledge and understanding of the prison system is, particularly since I spent so many years in elected office. But it's not helping. You know, this all being so rigid and so careful and so exclusive doesn't seem to be improving the situation in the communities.
Right. And I see it improving a little bit. And I think we turned back to a more liberal situation now. Even Biden was a tough on crime guy like all the Republicans and Democrats were in the 90s. We lost Pell Grants, you know, in the 90s. Maryland had 1,000 inmates in college in the early 90s. And in one
fell. 1,000 inmates. Mm-hmm. All and, public colleges?
Well, Goucher was involved, I suppose. They're involved now, I suppose. Okay. About that time. But they were, you know, a number of University of Maryland, Baltimore campus, you know, some of the community colleges. And people would go. They would take to be bused from minimum security to college and picked up at the end of the day. And that was going along very successfully, and there's very little problems with it. But somebody in Annapolis, I think a politician complained because somebody complained to him or her that they think these people are all committing crimes. So the state police set up a big raid and then they pulled everybody in. They didn't find one person who was not at college or who was committing a crime, but the program was ended with the Pell Grant as well, you know. And so we didn't have state funds. We still don't in Maryland for college. So that's how tragic things can be.
Wow. Steve, at my request, you sent me some articles that you have written for me to read in preparation for this interview. And you wrote that federal and state governments have spent enormous sums of money in recent decades to arrest, prosecute, and sentence criminals. Could those expenses be lower if even a fraction of the funds were redirected to a quality prison education program?
Well, over the recent years, many studies have been done. First, it was done primarily with substance abuse programs and mental health programs. Those programs, if implemented professionally in a prison setting with, you know, bona fide programs, not just a little bit of counseling here and there, those programs pay for themselves. The money invested comes back. So a dollar spent gets roughly $3 or $4 back in future benefits in terms of reduction in crime. That's been verified. So many states have implemented a lot more substance abuse programs and mental health programs as a result. The same is true of education. And the RAND Corporation, in their 2014 study on recidivism in education, concluded that if you spend a dollar today sending people to literacy programs or high school programs or college or vocational programs, $5 are returned in future diminution of crime. In other words, that you're cutting out that much future crime. And that, so $1 spent brings back $5, you know, in the future. Otherwise, you're going to have to spend
$5. Pretty big margin.
Yeah. And so the problem is educators aren't very good at PR. The substance abuse people have been very good and they've gotten a lot of programs built. And some of it has been at the expense of other programs, education money. A lot of it's been shifted to substance abuse. So we spend a lot less money now on education than we did 20 years ago. That was pointed out in the RAND study as well. But there's been a reduction in Maryland's included, and in most states, and the federal amount of money has been put in has either remained stagnant or cut back until recently with Pell Grants being reinstated, which is terrific, you know.
Okay. So
that's a hopeful sign.
That is a hopeful sign. Am I right that you began your career as a correctional education teacher?
Well, I was a high school teacher before. And then I came in and I ended up being like a resource teacher. I came in to help straighten out a program, Title I monies, which goes for inmates 21 and under, because there are a lot of them in the system.
21 and under.
Yep, there were hundreds, if not 1,000 in Maryland out of the 25,000 inmates at the time who were that, you know, 18 to 21 years old. And so those programs were not being run properly. There was an exception, a federal exception. So they brought in a professor of mine and he brought me in to help straighten out that program. And that's how I got started. And so I would go in and train teachers, because they were doing social work instead of education. So I was training staff teachers to do things that met Title I requirements, teaching reading, teaching math. And that's how I started. And I did that for a number of years. I was the resource teacher. And then I became the director of the program. And eventually I was in charge of high school equivalency, special education, literacy programs, things like that. As I sort of worked my way up. And then I did some national work. I got, with the permission of the state, at that time, the state superintendent of schools, Nancy Grasmick, took a part-time job with the National Correctional Education Association. It's the professional association for teachers in prisons and jails. And so I did that part-time with their permission, coinciding with my time with the state. And that's why I would meet you, because I was given time to go down to Annapolis. Okay. Dr. Grasmick, in her great wisdom, said, oh, I have another person to go down to Annapolis for me and push education. So she supported my efforts on behalf of the state as well as the association.
Well, I'm glad that you remember that better. Your memory is better than mine is. Was there anything in your family background that inspired you to be so dedicated to the education of prisoners so that they can function as productive members of our society?
I don't know. I think my father, when I reflected back, my father was an immigrant from Austria, and he came to this country and he was a construction guy. He ran big construction jobs. He started as a carpenter and worked his way up. And he was an equal opportunity guy. He had crews working for him. He had an Italian crew and a German crew and a black crew and all that. His idea was if you work, you got a job. And he had people follow him everywhere. And he had a very large number of African-Americans who just devoted to him because it was hard for them to keep jobs given all the prejudice. And so I grew up knowing a lot of minorities because some of them became my dad's best friends. So I had a little bit of that background, but I didn't have any, well, I did find out something that at some point. I came back to Chicago on a visit where I grew up. I was going to go to Cook County Jail to look at a program and ask my dad if he'd drive me there. My dad was about 70 at the time, and it was in a hard place to go and by a bus. So I said, we'd drive me. So we got there, and I figured my father would not want to go into jail. So the guy invited him, you can come in, Mr. Stewart. And so he came in, and next thing I know, my father's walking around talking to all the inmates. I tell you, just
great story.
This is weird. You know, like people usually shy away, you know. So I got outside afterward and I said, Dad, well, how come you were, you know, I didn't think you would be comfortable. I was a tough guy and all. He said, I spent 5 days there in 1927.
Oh, my heavens. Wow.
He got in a fight with some policemen and he beat a few of them up, supposedly. So he told me. And then he ended up in jail. So maybe that was deep down in my genes. I have no idea. I never was a fist. I mean, I typical kid getting fights, but I never did that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it gave him an opportunity to have a confession with his son, I guess. I don't know. I can tell from the way you talk about him that you hold him in very, very high regard.
Yeah, he thought what I was doing was terrific. You know, a lot of parents would say, why are you doing this, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Or why don't you stop doing this?
Yeah.
Do you see any signs of hope on the horizon or even in the present that could lead to more former prisoners serving as productive members of our society and using their skills to contribute to an overall improvement in quality of life?
I do see with the reinstitution of Pell Grants, we're going to see, for example, a lot more people going to college here in Maryland. We have some grants that started in the last few years, but now Goucher and Anne Arundel Community College and a couple other Eastern Shore, Warwick Tech on the Eastern Shore, and one other, but I don't recall right now, but University of Baltimore have programs, and they'll probably expand because now, you know, the problem is we're getting less money to prepare people for college. Most people are not ready for college, even with their high school diplomas. Their skill levels are such a need remediation. Their reading, their math scores are low, and now we have national data on that. And so put the programs in, but we might not be able to supply the students in the numbers that they, you know, could expand them. So I'm pushing for it at the national level. That's why we're doing this GED study, how many people got their GED. So we can, you know, try to get more money to provide high school level programs. If you get a high school diploma now, that doesn't mean you're gonna get a good job. And if you get a high school diploma and you just skim by and don't have the skills, higher level skills for college or for career tech programs without college are hard to do now too, because you have to have computer skills and math skills. So most of the people behind bars do not have these skills. So unless we pay attention to our basic skill programs, our high school skill programs, people may not get to the level where they can get a good job. And that's one of the determiners of whether they're going to stay out, paying job.
So many things connected. I'm surprised to hear you mention Goucher so often. I grew up in Baltimore, as did both of my parents. And I was a pretty good high school student, and I wanted to go to Goucher, and I was accepted, but my parents didn't have sufficient funds to send me there. So I went to the University of Maryland College Park, which turned out, you know, just fine. But I'm surprised that a private college, and I think it's great. I think it's great that Goucher is so active, but I'm surprised to hear you mention them so often. Since they are a private school, is there something I'm missing here?
I don't know the whole history, but a group of female judges in Maryland started that program with the women.
I'll be darned.
Mm-hmm. And then the men got angry because they didn't have one because the Pell Grants were gone. And so then they started one at the men's institution nearby in Jessup, and they've expanded. And then they got Pell Grants. During the Obama administration, they started doing experimental Pell Grants. There was a little clause that you could spend money for experiments. So Obama got this idea of experimenting with prisons, and it worked out. They got 60 or 70 programs around the country, and Maryland got a couple of them.
I see.
And then along came the Trump administration. I figured, oh boy, here goes. But Jared Kushner, because his father spent time in Federal Bureau of Prisons, was very interested in prison reform, and they kept and expanded those Pell Grants, they up to 130 programs. And then and several Republicans who were very prison reformed supported it. And just in the end of the Trump administration, Pell Grant restoration was signed by the president. So now it's going to take a year or two to get it up and running. And we're sending questions to the new secretary saying, we've got all the regulations you need now. We can show you how they work. So we're trying to get them to push that up instead of having it start in 2023, maybe this year, you know, coming. That's optimistic, but we still need more other monies. And so we're working for that with Congress.
Hopefully we will have a better understanding of the importance of this to everyone. It's not just for the benefit of the prisoners. It's for the benefit right across the board. I don't want to talk too much about the local system, but I'm very interested in what you said about women's colleges and some women judges, Lynn Battaglia, who lives here in Howard County, and Diane Schulte, two of my friends who had a big influence on me in deciding to go to law school. So it's good to hear that women are also making their contribution to this serious issue. Can you single out any one misinformed concept in our nation that prohibits or diminishes the possibility of former prisoners becoming contributing members to a strong democracy?
You know, I think this whole Black Lives Matter thing is important. You know, the majority of people who go to prison are minority. And we have this terrible tradition in our country. I don't care what they call it. It's systemic. You can deny it, but I'm a believer that we were raised with certain prejudices and certain things we've been doing over the years, which seem to be, you know, coming up again in many ways. When you put down a minority group, you strip them of opportunities and things, and you break the families. They're not strong as they should be. They can't object. Then you put down sentences that are longer for them for similar crimes for white people. And so we have a, if we fight racism, and if we really sincerely start trying to treat people equally, I think that would be a much less incarceration attitude. So that's one of the things. I do think our extreme individualism in this country is, you know, I have a right to this. I have a right to not wear my mask. I have a right to, but you don't teach responsibility. And so it leads to this whole thing about you made a mistake, tough. You got to do it on your own. You don't want to give people, you know, a lot of opportunity and help. You know, they got to do it on their own or forget about it. And so that's a different attitude. I've seen in other countries where the community has a responsibility, but we don't see that as much in this country. But the opportunity to spend some time going to a lot of places in Europe for conferences and visiting prisons and talking with officials, even in the middle of China for regular crimes, not political crimes. The community stuff they were doing, the reentry they were doing was very impressive. Japan was another good example. I had a good chance to spend some time in Japan. So our attitude as a country, you know, I'm as much an American as anybody around, but I don't want to accept the things that I think that we need to change. And I think those are the attitudes that are hindering us. So if we look at a little more community spirit, we look at our racial history and try to change some of those things, I think we could do a lot more to to cut down on the amount of crime, the amount of people going to prison. We tend to send people to prison for things that other countries don't. We're very severe in our punishment.
I was not taken aback. I was surprised to hear you mention the wearing of masks during this pandemic. And it has been a shock to me. I think of myself as being quite caught up with what's going on in the world, what's going on in our nation, our country, our state, our county. And I have been surprised and stunned by the number of people, even in the face of the statistics of how this virus is spreading, who say, you're not going to take away my freedom. I'm not going to wear a mask. I've just been, I don't know what it says about me. I guess I'm not as well informed as I thought I was. But it has been more than a little bit troubling. And then whatever comes from that, we certainly can't blame that on the people who are in prison, right?
Right. Just look at how some other countries have managed to say, as a group, we need to act this together, you know? A number of countries, not everybody, but, you know, most countries have accepted the shutdowns and all that because it's necessary and have responsibility to each other. But we have this, you know, attitude that in our country that individual freedom, the same thing shows up, I think, in gun control. I have a right to a tank or something. What's the limit here? You know, you have an AR-15, so what else can you have? A bazooka? I mean, I just don't get that. And, you know, I'm politically, I'm sure I get in a lot of hot trouble, you know, with some people about that, those kind of concepts. But I think, forget about gun control. We are very individualistic. We don't take responsibility for each other and as much as we ought to. We have many exceptions to that. We have tremendous people doing, and so all kinds of charities in this country doing terrific things. But as an individual attitude, it's not good.
I agree with you. I mean, I am very grateful to be a citizen in the United States and having lived my life here and know or certainly expect to live the rest of my life out here. But I don't want to get melodramatic here, but I've been startled by how that has shown up. And hopefully more younger people, not that they've caused the problems, the younger people, but they will learn what it means to be a contributing member of a strong democracy. So let's wrap up with this, Steve. I'm learning so much from my conversations with you, not only online right now, but that we've had before about the prison system. I find it very encouraging talking to you that it is possible that we can make improvements in our prison system and help the people who are prisoners. But do you feel, in closing, I'll ask you this, are you feeling more or less hopeful about the future of the prison system in the United States?
I'm feeling a little bit more hopeful. Let me close with this. I met Chief Justice Burger years ago when I got started. It's by chance I was lucky to have lunch at the Supreme Court with a group of people. And he had a quote that I put in my paper. I can't do it verbatim right now, but he said we have a moral obligation to do something about people when they're in prison, because otherwise they're just going to return the same way. We need to do something to change them. Most people in this country don't believe that was a conservative justice, and we have a moral obligation. We don't act like we have a moral obligation towards people in prison. If we did, then we'd all have this attitude and we try to do something. So what I've been always trying to do, because I'm trying to get people to feel moral about it, is, you know, I'm not going to be a priest or a, you know, minister to get out there and talk like that. But I try to show the profits that we make by spending a dollar, getting five back in terms of less crime and the jobs that we can help create, you know, for people, et cetera. So I try to get it to people that if you don't do anything, you're going to be worse off. If you do something, you're going to be much, much better off. It pays back to us for the money we invest. So that's the way I talk to people, conservative, and everybody seems to understand that argument pretty well.
Well, thank you. Very comprehensive answer to my question. And thanks for coming on for this interview, Steve. I've learned so much from you. I truly have. I don't say that to everyone I've interviewed. And I'm really grateful to you, not only for the work you have done and the work you're continuing to do, but that you have added on educating the rest of us who don't have as much of an understanding of the prison system and the people living in it as we could very well have. I have a much better understanding than I did when I first talked to you a month ago. And I've been involved in government and all those kinds of things. So I'm very grateful to you. And I look forward to seeing you around the hood.
Okay. Thank you. And I appreciate all you've done for this community and for this state and the county. And so thank you. And thank you for having me.
Be well.
You too.
This has been Reflections on Life. Be well and stay safe.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.